Today's Teisho will be on case 67 in the Book of Serenity. Case 67 is entitled The Flower Ornament Scripture's Wisdom. Introduction. One atom contains myriad forms. One thought includes a billion worlds. What about a powerful man who wears the sky on his head and stands on the ground, a spiritually sharp fellow who knows the tale when the head is spoken of? Doesn't he turn his back on his own spirit and bury away the family treasure? Case. The flower ornament scripture says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. Verse. Sky covers, earth bears, making a mass, making a clump, pervading the universe without bound, breaking down subatomic particles with no inside, getting to the end of the mysterious subtlety. Who distinguishes turning towards and away? Buddhas and patriarchs come to pay the debt for what they said. Ask old teacher Wang of Nanchuan. Each person just eats one stalk of vegetable. So I want to thank you all for being here and for doing such a good job this morning in the Zendo. As I said before breakfast, everybody was sitting so deeply. It's really wonderful to see that kind of wholehearted practice. And it is wholehearted. It really takes a whole heart to practice like that. And that's wonderful to see. It's an absolutely pure pleasure to practice with everybody here. Last night, people came into Dokusan, and it was clear to me everybody's really throwing themselves into their practice. And that's wonderful, really magical. So we've been talking about trust. And so much of life is about trust in general. And right now, trust has become a big issue because, if you're addicted to the news, as I am, it's almost the case every day, long before people tried to destroy the Capitol, as it turns out, capture and execute some of our elected leaders, as they've discovered today. Long before then, we already had a lot to feel distrustful about, corroding our trust. If you trust somebody, that seems trivial, but it's actually quite important. We trust our parents to love and take care of us, right? When we're little kids. And sometimes they don't do that. Sometimes they don't. They don't do that. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, I think it's the 400 Blows, 400 Blows by Francois Truffaut. But it's a fantastic movie because it's about little kids in Paris who have been basically abandoned by their parents. The main character has a father who is hardly ever home. He lives along with his father. I think his father has a drinking problem. As you watch the movie, this kid in particular is sort of like neglected by everybody around him. The teachers, he gets in trouble because He's a little kid. He cuts up in class. He's really asking for, see me, please. And, you know, of course, if you act up in class, you get noticed, but in the wrong way. You know, in those days, you would get a swat in the head. That would be illegal here now, but that's what would happen. And so, you know, he finally feels alienated from school. And his home is unsustaining, and he stops going to school, right? And the movie is called The 400 Blows, you know, because he gets blows everywhere he turns, right? It's like this little kid who just, he's really wants to be nourished, and his environment just doesn't sustain him. So, you know, it kind of fits in with what we've been talking about this week, you know, with Nanchuan hitting Linji and the blows that Nansen gave to Rinzai. But you know, this little kid gets his blows. We trust our parents to care for us, and sometimes they let us down. You know, we trust the people we work for and work with to have our interests at heart. Right, have our interests at heart. But they don't always do that. You know, when I got out of college, I traveled across the United States, and I had a number of jobs. When I was in college, I had summer jobs working construction, in the construction industry. And I started out as a laborer, but I worked my way up to a framing carpenter. And framing carpenters are people who put up the walls, those they're called studs, those wooden studs. They're 8 feet long, and they're basically 2x4s that are 8 feet long. And so I made my living for a while framing houses that were big, new houses. And I got good at that. You know, you're actually rewarded for being fast. And the faster you can work, the better, because they can build more houses. And a team of carpenters can go in and they'll pour a cement slab, and the team of carpenters can go in and almost frame the whole house in a day if they're very good. And then the sheetrockers come in and put on the sheetrock. They put in the insulation. They put on the exterior paneling. Roofers come in and put on the roofing. But the framing carpenter is the least skilled carpenter, right? He does the least skilled job, basically. So I did that work in college, and it got me through college. I could make enough to pay my tuition every year. This was a long time ago when you could pay your tuition with your summer job. And then I went out west, and I got a job in Albuquerque as a framing carpenter. And I called somebody once, and I said, "Listen, he advertised in the Albuquerque Tribune for framing carpenters." So he said, "Oh, you sound like just the person I'm looking for." And I was running out of money, so I thought, "Oh, this is going to be great." So I went out to the site, and what do you know? Instead of me and like three other carpenters, there are 20 carpenters. I'm not kidding. And he had like four houses. And basically what he did was say, "You three are on that house, you three are on that house, you three are on that house, and you three are on that house." And basically what he wanted to see was who were the fastest carpenters. So he didn't actually have a stopwatch, but it was like that, right? So basically, he said, "Get going, guys." And, you know, he just wanted to see who got most of those houses built at the end of the day. And so, you know, I wanted this job desperately. So I was like framing like a madman. And then I had to put on this, exterior cladding. It's like plywood. It's really a creosote. It's a creosote soaked composite, right? And they're very heavy, right? And I've always been rather thin, you know, so I didn't have a lot of bulk. Managing one of those by myself is difficult. So what you're supposed to do is put it, you're supposed to put it in the instep of your foot, actually, and hold it with one hand and put, use the instep of your foot to lift it up, and then you nail it while you're holding it like that, right? So it's challenging. So at the end of the day, you know, I worked my tail off, and at the end of the day, he sort of said, you stay. And the, it's like the rest of you bums go, right? And it was like he gave us like $50 cash for the day or something like that. You know? Now, you know, I felt disillusioned by that and soon got out of the building trades. I actually had another job where I built a house and the guy stiffed me too, right? So then I went into restaurant work because you get paid every 2 weeks. So, you know, basically there's a lot that erodes our trust in the world, right? A lot of things in life undermine our trust. I was just reading today that the President of the United States is going to not pay his lieutenant, Rudy Giuliani, for legal services. So he's going to betray his own lieutenant, right? Okay. So we know trust cannot be given to Mr. Trump, right? But lots of people will disappoint you in this world, right? And things will disappoint you. So, you know, when I got out of college, one of my aspirations was to be a novelist, you know. So I saved up a ton of money doing construction before I went into the Southwest. I was living in Seattle. And I worked almost for a year to save enough money to write a novel. And I had all these notes for this novel I wanted to write. And I had published a few short stories, so I had reason to think it might be possible to be a novelist. And I threw myself into this, you know. And I was sure that if I just wrote this novel, it was going to be a great novel. And I'm very motivated, you know. I'm very disciplined. And I got up every day and I would work on this thing for like 10 hours, you know. And after like 6 months, I had like this block of material. It was like 400 pages. And I sat down to read it, you know, and I put it away actually for a little while after I finished writing it. And I went backpacking up in the Olympic Mountains and I came back and I wanted to look at it with fresh eyes. And I thought, you know, I had this vision. I was going to sit down and read it and go, oh my God, you know, this is War and Peace. This is brilliant, you know. And as I read it, I had this sinking feeling like this was going down in flames. You know, I thought, well, it can't be that bad. So I showed it to one of my friends, somebody who, you know, is a good friend. And he was honest with me. You know, like he was somebody I could trust. You know, and he said, well, you know, not everybody publishes their first novel, you know. So look, I trusted the process, right? And it didn't produce a masterpiece. In fact, it didn't even produce a publishable book. And I think I eventually threw it away, but I was carrying it around in a briefcase for like 30 years, right? Just, it was sitting in my basement because I couldn't bear to give up on this, you know, maybe the day will come when people realize this is a masterpiece. So there's a lot of reasons not to be trustful. Right, a lot of reasons, and if you trust life, you're going to be disappointed a lot. That's just a fact. On the other hand, let me go on with that just a little bit. You know, the interesting thing about trust, though, is this. I mean, you know, if you have two countries. Or two people who don't trust each other. Say there's somebody in your neighborhood and you've had some bad conflicts with him, right? And maybe he's betrayed you or let you down. Or maybe you let him down, or maybe you betrayed him, right? You know, or maybe he thinks you betrayed him and you think he betrayed you. You know, so both of you are in a state of like not trusting the other person. And in order to repair that situation, what has to happen is that somebody has to trust first, right? Somebody has to trust first. But if you trust first, there's a, especially if you've been burned, there's a high chance, right, that you're going to get burned again, right? So why do you trust? Why do you trust? You know, I mean, we do this all the time, right? You know, we get disappointed, but then we go on. And you can say, well, why do we trust after we've been hurt or after we've been burned? And some people would say hope. Well, it's hope. You're hoping for the best. But I think hope and trust are different. I really do. You know, I think hope, which is a good thing in itself, right, is based on the idea that sooner or later, things are going to get better. Okay? So you meet this guy named Donald Trump. And you ask him to lend you, he asks you to lend him $5. And you lend him $5 and he says, I'll pay you on Tuesday. And then Tuesday comes and he doesn't pay you. And then, you know, a week goes by and he comes by and says, listen, could you lend me $5? I'll pay you on Wednesday. And you think, God, he stiffed me last time, but I'm hoping he'll do better, right? I'm hoping he'll do better. And then he doesn't pay you next week, right? So I think hope is based upon this idea that things are going to get better. Things are going to get better. But I'm not sure trust is based on that calculus. See, I think trust doesn't really care how it turns out. I really believe that. You know, in other words, you know, I think hope can be disappointed, but I don't think trust can be disappointed. Because, you know, I think when two people are in like a standoff, right, one person has to trust first, and there's a high probability that the other person will betray him. Why does that person take the risk? You know, I think that that trust... The person who takes the risk says this, you know, I don't want to live without being a trusting person, even if it injures me. Even if it injures me. You know, I'm going to trust even though it injures me, because it's more of an injury to be a distrust life than it is to trust life and get burned. It's more of an injury. So I ultimately think that trust doesn't come from our circumstances. I think trust is something we live in, and probably we live in by choice. You know, I think we choose to be trusting. You know, my father-in-law, Jack Sutman, was a design engineer at Los Alamos Labs in New Mexico. And he was like the most trusting person I ever met in my life, and I have nothing but admiration. And many people would say he was hopelessly naive person. And by the way, I loved my father-in-law so much. Maybe that's why I married my wife. I think I was really in love with my father-in-law, so I married his daughter. I think that must have been it, you know. But just kidding, of course, if anybody's listening, you know, so. You know, he was the kind of person who would trust people and they would not carry out they would not follow through, right? So he was this crazy design engineer, and he loved old cars. And he would buy an old car, and he had this, like, basically he had like a shop in his garage, an automobile shop and a wood shop. And he did the plans for his house. He designed his house. He did a lot of the carpentry himself, and in his spare time. And he had like this automobile shop, and his I don't even know where spark plugs go, but he was very good at this. And anyway, he'd gotten this old car, and he took it to a place, and the guy said, "Don't worry, you know, I can fix this up." And the guy never returned the car, you know. And Jack trusted him, and you know, he actually didn't take him to court. It was like I said, "Aren't you going to take him to court?" He said, "He's going to bring it back." Now, you know, some people would say he's repressing or he's not facing the facts, you know, but I saw him operate like this a lot. And I think he just decided it's more important for me to be a trusting person than it is to worry about this car. You know, that trust is a kind of relationship with the world. Not just with other people, but with the world and with other people and with ourselves. That's really like paradise. And I realize there are people who say that's crazy, but you know, if you think about it, every good thing in this world comes from people like that. Because, you know, when you look at the world, it's a dirty, rotten place, right? It's a really screwed up, totally terrible place in a lot of ways, right? And yet, you know, it has somehow gotten better. It has somehow gotten better because people trust in the absence of evidence, you know? In the absence of evidence, people change, you know? I was just watching this show about a white supremacist. And he at some point he had some experiences in his life that just convinced him he was on a bad path, and he renounced his beliefs, right? And he just said, this is it, I'm so sorry, I was wrong. And he goes around talking to like communities about white supremacist thinking and so on. And you know, you would never have guessed, right? You know, people can surprise you, you know, sometimes. So when I was, you know, it's like Zen practice. You know, Zen practice is like this too. You know, if you have a relatively, you know, when you come to Sesshin, it would be nice to answer your koan, right? It'd be nice. And yet, you know, sometimes you don't answer your koan. And that just happens, right? It just happens. You know, the teacher gives you a koan, and then you go to the next session, and you think, okay, I'm going to answer this koan. But, you know, you don't answer it. And some people get upset about that. You know, there was a couple that used to sit with our group. And they were very, I must say, they had many wonderful qualities, but they were very competitive people, right? And they would come to Sesshin, and as this week was going on, if they weren't answering their koan, I could feel that they would come into Dokusan, it would sort of like radiate pressure, right? It was like, I could feel the pressure, you know, it was like they wanted to pass their koan, right? And it's natural. But the pressure was like astonishing, right? And you know, that just had that mindset, right? It was like, I'm hunting for an answer to my koan, and I want to go home with my trophy, my koan trophy. Or I've invested all this time, I want an answer, you know, I want some payback on my time. So, you know, but actually, you know, and I was under pressure. I had to think, oh my God, should I pass? That's a really poor answer. Should I pass it? They might not come back, right? And sometimes I wouldn't pass it, and I could see that they were really like looking like daggers at me, right? You know, it's like, okay. When I started doing Zen practice, I had a lot of trouble with many aspects of the practice. You know, I think I was mildly depressed. I don't think I was clinically depressed, but I think I was sort of mildly depressed. And I went to do meditation at the Seattle Zen Center. And when I started meditating, I immediately felt better, even though it was so hard physically. I was not very flexible. And sitting on the ground for, you know, sitting on the ground for an hour and a half was murder, right? And I would be covered in sweat. But I would go home and feel so much better, so much better. So I got into this Zen thing. And I also read some books like The Way of Zen and things. It was just, I was sold, right? This was wonderful. So, you know, I started studying with Takabayashi Genki Roshi. And my dream was to be like a great Zen master, right? You know, like the all like Jiaozhou and Nanchuan and Linji, you know, Rinzai and Nansen and Joshu, right? You know, oh, you know, who doesn't want to be like those guys? So, you know, I started with Genki doing koan practice, and he gave me the breath perception koan. The first koan is just watch your breath and see what happens with your breath. And, you know, I thought it was like, I thought it was almost like an insult that he gave me this koan. It was like, come on, I want the real stuff, not this beginner stuff. You know, so I thought, okay, I'll watch the breath for a while. And I would come in to see him, and he'd say, well, tell me about your breath. And I'd say, the breath goes in my nose and out my nose, in my nose and out my nose. He'd go, oh, you know, usually in Zen, the teacher has a little bell. It's not like this, it's a little tiny bell. And he goes, that means the interview is over. So I'd come in and I'd see him and he'd say, tell me about your breath. And I'd say, the breath goes in, the breath goes out. Like, what else is there? You know? And I kept going in and getting the bell, right? And I couldn't understand what was going on. And, you know, I tried so many things. You know, I'd write poetry. I brought him flowers, you know. I brought him a piece of a sandwich once, you know, and it would just be like, you know, every time. So finally, you know, we'd go to these sesshin. This was before we had our own place. We'd go to different places. We'd drive out to different places that were like retreat centers or facilities we could use for sesshin, like Murray Grove. And we'd drive back, and you know, we would all drive back together to save on gas and everything. It was just nice rather than driving up by yourself. Sometimes we'd have to drive 100 miles or something. So I remember coming back from one sesshin, and we were all in this woman named Regina. She was a dancer in a dance troupe in Seattle. And we were all in the bus, this Volkswagen bus together. And everybody, please don't do this, but don't talk about your koans with anybody, even your spouse. You know, don't talk about your koans with your spouse or with your friends. Just, it's between you and your true nature, and I'm the coach. I'm helping you, see. But don't talk to people about it. Don't. But, you know, in this case, people were all blabbing about their koans. And someone, you know, they'd all be driving home and somebody would say, well, I did it. I answered my koan, you know, and which one? What was your answer? You know, it's like, you know, and I was sitting there and I was so ashamed because I didn't answer my koan, you know. And then I went to the next sesshin and I would come out, you know, I'd go into Dokusan and then I'd come out and I would go into Dokusan. You know, some people would go into Dokusan and they'd be there for 15 minutes. And, you know, the Roshi liked to move people through. So somebody would be in there for 15 minutes. You knew something was going on in that room. And I would like set time records, like speed records, right? I'd get in, get out, get in. It was like zoom, you know. So people could tell he didn't have the answer, right? So, you know, people would go into Dokusan, they'd stay there for 20 minutes, I'd go in and I'd barely sit down and I'd be out, right? And at the end of every, you know, sometimes at the end of the session, I'd see these glowing faces, like, you know, progress. So this went on for almost 4 years. And you know, the thing is, at first I was shocked, you know, because I was really trying, and I got to be a really good sitter. You know, I could sit. I used to sit, you know, half lotus and full lotus, and I could sit full lotus for 10 minutes, and then I would sit full lotus for 15 minutes, and then I would sit full lotus for 20 minutes, and I could sit full lotus finally for like an hour, and I still couldn't answer this goddamn koan, right? And so at first I was challenged. Then I was, you know, then I was baffled, you know, and then I was a little bit angry. But I couldn't really be mad at Genki Roshi because he was such an adorable person. He was such a good man. So I couldn't really, there really wasn't any reason to get mad at him. He was so kind, right? You know. So anyway, then I got down on myself. But, you know, I didn't quit. I just kept going. I just kept going. And if somebody had said to me, why are you doing this? I would not have had an answer. You know, I wouldn't have had an answer. You know, you've been practicing Zen for 4 years and you haven't answered the most elementary koan, right? Why are you doing this? But you know, it's trust. It's trust, you know? Living in that trust, you know, I was living in trust. First of all, it made me feel better, I must admit. But you know, that feeling of the being one with the trusting mind, right? I know this is my path. I knew this was my path. It was just, I have never had a doubt, you know? I've never had a doubt. If you have doubts, don't worry about it. But for me, this was just crystal clear, right? But I wasn't getting any payback, right? It was like, you know, but I didn't care because it wasn't about the payback. It was about being one, it was my path, and then it was about being one with the trusting mind. It's like whatever happens is okay. I will trust whatever happens. See? That was so important. That was more important than anything. That's like the guy who says, okay, he might have a gun in his coat and he might shoot me. But you know, I'm going to make a gesture, knowing he might kill me, because living in constant distrust is worse than getting killed. I want to live a trusting life, right? And ultimately, it's not about the other guy. It's about our relationship to the world, right? So you know, actually, I think that's a superior way to live. I really do. You know, we can't control outcomes. We can't control outcomes. They have nothing to do with us, right? You know, we do our best, but the forces around us are vast, right? And you know, we tend to personalize when things happen because we don't want to admit we're helpless. But I think the best response for feeling helpless is trust. It's just, okay, I can't control this. I'm going to live on trust, right? I'm going to live on trust. I whatever happens is helping me wake up. And, you know, is helping me wake up. And somebody could say, well, oh yeah, when have you wakened up? Maybe you haven't had your Daiken show yet, but who cares, right? I mean, look, you want to know something? Some people practice Zen, like Zhao Zhou had a Daikensho when he was like 19 years old. And he was a great Zen master. There was another great Zen master, really the greatest Zen master in the last like 400 years. His name is Xu Yun, Empty Cloud. And Empty Cloud became a monk when he was like 17 or 18 years old. His father married him off, was afraid he was going to become a monk, and married him off to two women. This was pre-Republic of China. So sometimes you had multiple wives if you were a man. And he married, and Xu Yun was so determined to become a monk, he said to his wives, listen, I don't want to be your husband. I want to be a monk. And they said, great, we respect that. And eventually they became nuns and he became a monk and they all practiced Zen. And one of his wives became a great, great Zen teacher in her own right. So he was like 17, right after his dad died, he left his wives, he entered the Sangha, he became a monk. And he practiced for like 50 years before he had his great awakening experience. And, you know, I don't think he cared. You know, the deepest practice, you know, Zhao Zhou had his great awakening experience when he was 17. And Xu Yun practiced for 50 years before he had his great awakening experience. And I think Xu Yun's practice was deeper than Zhao Zhou's practice. See, I think Xu Yun's practice was deeper because he didn't ask for results. He knew he was on the path, right? He knew he was on the path. And he followed that path with a trusting heart. And for such a person, see, the payback doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And I think this is living in the trusting mind. I think this is the highest teaching, actually. The highest teaching. Because, you know, no matter, think of it. You know, there have been people who were prime ministers of countries you've never heard of, and I've never heard of, right? And they gave their hearts to save their country, right? You know, and the country was wiped off the map, right? It's a fact. You know, but was that a waste of effort? Was that a waste of effort? And I say no. You know, almost so much of what we do isn't going to work out. It isn't going to work out. You know, you might or might not write that novel and get it published. You know, and 10 years from now, people might remember it or not. You know, things are uncontrollable. Those are uncontrollable. You know, some of you know there's this book that I have on the reading list for our website, and it's called Bones of the Master. And I think it's a masterpiece myself. I highly recommend it. And I read it like, I don't know, 20 years ago, something like that. And it blew me away. I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a bestseller. This is going to, you know, it was in the remainders by the, you know, four years later. Yeah, I think you can get it on Amazon for $1 if you can get it. You know, so why was that masterpiece not read? You know, it's a truth. Masterpieces go unread all the time. And junk, you know, I used to have a friend in the book business, and there was a book, I don't know if you heard of it, it's a diet, sort of a diet book. It's called Skinny Bitch. Have anybody ever heard of that book, Skinny Bitch? Skinny Bitch is this very funny book. Okay. So my friend's in the book, she was a book producer, and she read this. She got this manuscript for a book called Skinny Bitch. And she read it and thought, oh, this is junk. This is going nowhere. So she passed on it, right? And of course, it became this huge bestseller. You can't control that stuff. You know, it's a book nobody is going to read in a decade, right? If they probably stopped reading it long ago. So you know, worrying about results is a bad way to live, in my opinion. And living on trust is so important. You know, rather than admit we don't control things, we beat ourselves up. You know, so we say, he offered me that job and I turned it down. You know, I mean, my friend could say, why didn't I publish Skinny Bitch? Why didn't I see that? What's wrong with me, right? You know, that's crazy. That's crazy. You know, she made the best decision. She made a good decision. I think it's junk myself, right? I think it's junk. You know, she had higher standards than that, right? So So look, she could blame herself for the next 50 years, but that's not a healthy way to live, and it's a self-deluding way to live. It's a self-deluding way to live. You know, we make the best decisions we can, and that's our karma. And we don't get to pick our karma, but we can work through our karma. How do we work through our karma? With a trusting mind, right? A trusting mind. When you know you're on your path, don't doubt yourself, right? If you don't have a path, look for your path. But if you have a path, trust yourself, you know, and don't ask for results. It's not about results. It's about feeling, you know, I know in my heart, I feel connected with life. This connects me with life. You know, this makes me feel alive. This makes me full of compassion. This makes me full of joy. See, and those things don't come from Amazon fulfillment centers, right? They come from living in trust. You know, if Xu Yun had not had his Daikensho when he was 68 or something like that, he would still have been the greatest Zen master of the last 400 years, in my opinion, because he so completely lived on trust. Birds live on trust. All other things live on trust, right? You know? One atom contains myriad forms. One thought includes a billion worlds. What about a powerful person who wears the sky on his head and stands on the ground, a spiritually sharp fellow who knows the tale when the head is spoken of? Doesn't he turn his back on his own spirit and bury away the family treasure? The flower ornament scripture says, I see now all sentient beings everywhere possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. That's living in trust. All, you know, look, every time you read about Donald Trump, right, and you think less of human beings as he's done everything he can to make sure you do, right? You know, just get this book out and read it. You know, I now see all sentient beings, even Donald Trump, fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So you can say, you'll wait for eternity before Donald Trump turns into a good person. Let's wait for eternity. Yeah, it's the best way to live.